Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Ideas Matter Podcast. We're here today with Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. Louis, would you like to give the correct pronunciation of that?
Tao Te Ching, which I don't know. I don't know why it's spelt with T's. I think like that was sort of like an early mid 20th century romanization of the Chinese. You see, so a lot of people mistakenly say like Tao, but it's actually pronounced with a D. It's Tao.
Right. There you go.
I have no idea why they did it with T's to begin with. Doesn't make much sense to me.
So we are here with the Tao Te Ching.
Yep, that was good.
And this is our first work of Chinese philosophy. I mean, with your thesis, we kind of talked about Confucianism, but this is our first sort of direct text of Chinese philosophy.
Mm.
And a particularly indirect ancient text as well. So let's just get right into it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, this is my second time reading the Tao Te Ching. And I really like it. It's really easy to read. Like you can literally just, it's 86 pages thereabouts, but it's each page is like four lines. Mm. So you can pretty much just sit down and read it in one setting. I really like it. I find it quite useful in terms of like a general philosophy for life. It's, you know, as you mentioned, like my research was sort of about Confucianism, but like, you know, a lot of something that people don't understand about like China is it's not like you're either a Confucianist or a Taoist or a Buddhist or whatever. They're much more sort of fluid. So people might, you know, practice Taoist principles in their daily life, or they might do Tai Chi, which is based on the philosophy of Taoism. But then when it comes to politics, they might be more Confucian, or they might like practice Confucian funeral rites. They might also have some Buddhist beliefs as well. So they're not mutually exclusive. They actually inform one another quite a lot. It's not like, you know, you're a Christian and therefore you can't be a Muslim. It's not like that at all. So all that is to say that when I was doing the stuff on Confucianism, and actually this is one of the comments that an anonymous reviewer had about my thesis, was I would have expected more Taoism given that it kind of provides the cosmological context for Confucianism and a lot of other Chinese thought. And by cosmological, it's just kind of like how the ancient Chinese sort of saw the nature of the universe and humanity's relationship to it. A lot of that is sort of expressed in Taoism, particularly in the Tao Te Ching. So it's a really, really good book. Although I appreciate if you're not familiar with Chinese philosophy, its indirectness can be sort of obtuse and you're like, what on earth is going on? What does this mean? That's literally nonsensical, or it's a deliberate contradiction. So yeah, I mean, this was your first time reading Chinese philosophy. So how did you cope with it?
Well, yeah, I found it quite difficult. I think a large part of it is just I lack the priors to make sense of a lot of it. Like you've already got that familiarity with the sort of Confucian tradition, whereas when I'm coming into this and Lao Tzu is talking about like nothingness and sort of talking about the way and all that in these very poetic sort of indirect ways, I found it quite hard to apprehend. I actually just this morning started a second read through just to make a bit more sense of it, and it is coming together a bit, but I think really good parts of it, like some very, like you said, those philosophy of life things, those existential, not existentialist parts of it that talk about like being a person living in the world and how do you manage making it through life.
Yeah,
that stuff I thought was really good, but the real sort of weight of the text is the idea of the way or the Tao.
The Tao, yeah.
And that is far more difficult to apprehend, though that isn't, at least in terms of Taoism itself, isn't much of a flaw in the philosophy. I think that's quite intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I forgot my copy of the book, but if you go to like the first page of like the actual text, I mean, the first line is like, you know, that which can be named is not. Yeah, there we go. So yeah, as Alex is saying, This is the first line of the text. The way that can be spoken of is not the constant way. The name that can be named is not the constant name. So I was thinking about that line this morning, actually, because there's sort of two like ways that you can read that. And the most dominant reading is this idea of the way is so ineffable and it's sort of beyond our human comprehension that any attempt to sort of stuff its complexity into our words is not going to do it justice. So anytime, another thing I should say to this is like Taoists often make fun of Confucianists for being these sort of like stuffy scholars who are absorbed in their books and try and like analytically understand everything. But the sort of general vibe of Taoism is like, well, if you do that, you don't actually have an understanding of reality. You really like pigeonholed yourself. So I think saying that which can be named is not the constant name is like them also making fun of scholars who are trying to name everything and study everything and sort of saying, well, no, you don't really understand the nature of reality if you're doing that because it's really like it's so ineffable. So that's another theme that's going on there. But it's also similar to this idea, of like in Islam where you're not supposed to like depict God because God is so beyond our comprehension that to do that you're inevitably going to do an injustice to God. It's a similar sort of idea. It's just really beyond our comprehension. But a third reading, and I don't know, this might not be one shared by anybody, but I just was sort of thinking about it this morning. It's like, well, the way is everything. Like the way sort of permeates the universe. And so in a certain sense, we could say everything is an instance of the way. But so we could name it, right? We could name like, you know, I was 5 minutes late to uni this morning, but that's okay, right? That's just like, that was going to happen. That's the way. But in naming that, like, that's not the capital W way or the capital D Tao. It's just a particular instance of it. So I think that's perhaps also what that means. So yeah, the ineffability of it is part of the design.
Yeah. And I remember when we were doing the St. Augustine episodes, I linked Augustine to this later medieval Catholic theologian called Meister Eckhart. And he has this passage where he says something really similar to this, and you actually brought up Taoism.
That, yeah.
Where he has this idea that, well, God is something so great and expansive and beyond our comprehension and ineffable that your understanding of it can't be collapsed into a three-letter word.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember you linking that to Taoism where you said, well, that just kind of sounds like the Tao.
Yeah.
Right? So would you say that's a fair characterization? It's something that's so... The Tao refers to some sort of... What would you say? Some sort of principle? Some force? What is the Tao? What are we talking about when we talk about the Tao?
There's a few analogies in the text which I like, and it's sort of... also illustrates how you should try and... So the general idea of Taoism, right, is that you should be in harmony with nature.
Mm-hmm.
So what I said before about this whole, like, Chinese cosmology, they really, like... And I don't know if you did the reading that I sent that was assigned to undergrads. He kind of explains it pretty well, where he talks about, like, the universe in Taoism is a series of concentric circles. And so you can imagine right in the middle we have humans, and then we have, like, families, and then we have nations... Then we have, like, I don't know, the world, and then we have the entire universe. And basically the idea of Taoism is that these are all interconnected. And harmony is when basically you in your life and in your family and in your nation mirror the natural harmony that is found in the universe. And as long as you follow that natural harmony, things will be good. You'll be happy, you'll live to a long age, you won't be stressed, you won't be anxious. All the problems in the world, to the Taoists, arise when humans, through our intelligence, become conceited and we try to force things to be another way than what they actually are. We go against the way, the natural harmony of things. And it's through that forcing, through that striving, that we run into trouble. So there's all these quotes or sort of aphorisms in the book about, you know when to stop, then you can endure. That's my personal favorite line. Or someone who strives will meet an untimely end. Like, that's a paraphrase, but that's the general gist, right? So it's all about this non-striving, or sometimes it's called effortless action or inaction, or the Chinese is wu wei. That's the general idea. So how does this link to the Tao? There's an analogy in the text about like running your cart through like tracks in the ground that have been made by previous carts. Or you can just think about this as like a train going on train tracks. Like, it's very easy to do that because they're running down a certain set of tracks. Or when you think about, you do a movement that you've done 1,000 times, you know, your neurons like develop more fat so they can fire more quickly. It's easier. Basically, the idea is like, you know, you're following the way when it's kind of easy, because the way is this sort of like these tracks that you're going down that reduce the sort of friction and tension in life. And that's the whole point of Taoism, is to try and get rid of that friction and tension by following the sort of natural harmony of the universe. Mm-hmm. Is that a little bit clearer?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So just for a bit of context, where sort of chronologically does this stand in relation to Confucianism? Like, were they contemporary?
That's a good question. So,
because the little bit of research I've done into it, a lot of the comparisons that made it make sense to me were as... Well, I don't know if this is sort of like a forced interpretation, but as somewhat of a reaction or a contrast to Confucianism, and that made it make a lot more sense. So where does this stand to Confucianism sort of in the timeline?
They're absolutely in dialogue with each other. And I guess the answer to your question is sort of in the debates about, well, was Lao Tzu or Lao Tzu like an actual person? Mm-hmm. And most scholars think that he probably wasn't. This is instead actually just a collection of sayings by various people. But the sort of mythology is that Lao Tzu was a contemporary of Confucius, and that they actually met. And Confucius like went to a different state to meet with Lao Tzu, and Lao Tzu kind of made fun of him. That's a sort of famous like story. So the mythology is that they were contemporaries.
I got the quote here from the introduction.
Yeah.
When Confucius went to Chou to ask to be instructed in the rites by him, Lao Tzu said, "What you are talking about concerns merely the words left by people who have rotted along with their bones. Furthermore, when a gentleman is in sympathy with the times, he goes out in a carriage, but drifts with the wind when the times are against him. I've heard it said that a good merchant hides his store in a safe place and appears to be devoid of possessions, while a gentleman, though endowed with great virtue, wears a foolish countenance. Rid yourself of your arrogance and your lustfulness, your ingratiating manners and your excessive ambition. These are all detrimental to your person. This is all I have to say to you."
Yeah, so he's definitely taking the piss out of Confucius and Confucianism there, because Confucianism is all about like observing rites and this sort of like ritual propriety. And there's this saying in the Analects that if the mat or the rug wasn't straight, the master wouldn't sit. So it's this kind of very almost, it's probably anachronistic to use this word, but like conservative morality and like decorum. And sort of trying to cultivate your virtue, and Lao Tzu's just sort of taking the piss out of that and calling him arrogant. Because all this stuff is ephemeral and it sort of changes with time, and it's a sort of contrivance of like humans. It's not actually like found in nature. I think that's the sort of general idea. So the mythology is that like the two thinkers were contemporaries, but in reality, Lao Tzu probably didn't actually exist. This book was compiled probably over centuries by different people. So Taoism more broadly is just like a school of thought, which, you know, would have definitely existed and informed Confucianism at the time as well. Because Confucianists also think that we should like try and follow the natural harmony of the universe. They just don't think that... So Taoists basically see us as like spontaneously and naturally doing that. And every time we try and strive, we go away from it. Whereas Confucians think that we have to actually like make effort to do this.
Right. So it's sort of like a dialogue between willing and non-willing.
Yeah. You could definitely see it like that. And there's another tradition as well, which is more overtly political, which is legalism. And the most famous thinker there is like Han Feizi. And I think like you can understand the sort of difference, like, Taoists think that humans are naturally and spontaneously good, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in the text about like if you praise people, you actually make them perform badly because other people will become resentful and jealous. So you don't want to actually like hold up anyone as an example, just let people naturally and spontaneously be good. So it's a sort of very like rosy-eyed view of human nature, whereas Confucianism is like, well, some Confucian thinkers will disagree, but broadly speaking, like humans are neither good nor bad. It's all about the societal context. It's about the sort of social apparatus that we construct, which determines human behavior. And the legalists, like, no, humans are bad.
Mm.
And so we need to like have a really powerful state capable of punishing them. It's kind of like legalists and Hobbes, if you want to think of that analogy. Confucianism, it's almost a sense in which it's like a degree, like, because Machiavelli was sort of like, it's all about the state, and that shapes human behavior. Human nature is very malleable, and then like humans are naturally good. I don't know where you might find that in
Rousseau.
Yeah, Rousseau. So there's kind of like that's the sort of difference that sort of runs the whole gamut.
Right, right. And you know, I love a bit of this in terms of historical context. It's thought that this text arose, like you said, it kind of came into form over centuries, most likely. But a lot of that was happening around the time of the Warring States period. Yeah. So what, just very briefly, what is the Warring States period?
I don't know as much about it as I should, the Warring States period. The Warring States period like took place before China was unified for the first time into one empire under the Qing dynasty, which didn't last very long. But yeah, so this took place beforehand, and it's sort of a period of Chinese history in which you had like, what did they say, like 100 schools of thought bloomed, or 1,000 schools of thought, which is a sort of like Chinese. In China, you often like find that like let a thousand ideas be heard, or you sort of hear that phrase quite a lot, and it's just kind of like a cultural thing. It's not literal. It's like there weren't literally 1,000 schools, but that's kind of just like how they speak metaphorically.
So there was like a flourishing of intellectual activity.
Yeah, there's a flourishing of intellectual activity because you had three states that were vying for dominance, and eventually they're all unified under the Qing. But it's an interesting period intellectually for reasons I just said, but also now like a lot of contemporary like Chinese international relations scholars are digging back and like looking at what Chinese thinkers said at the time about how these states interacted with each other and the sort of principles of international politics as trying to deliberately develop a theory of IR that doesn't just rely on like, you know, Napoleonic Europe as your sole case study, which a lot of IR thinkers do. So it's an interesting period in Chinese history, but frankly, I need to learn more about it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I was just asking because in the introduction, the translator talks a bit about the Warring States period, and he has an argument that a lot of the ideas of Taoism about non-action, about not striving for status or wealth and whatnot, is a reaction to this period because it was a time of, you know, a lot of instability and violence. So
yeah,
you wouldn't want to stand out. You wouldn't want to put yourself forward as someone being in power because there would be a fairly high likelihood that you would come to a lot of suffering by doing so.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that like those three schools of thought would all interpret that same period very, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Confucius is like, look, there's disorder under heaven. We need to recreate this harmonious order. And so Confucius is kind of like looking back at this imagined past when everything was better. The Taoists kind of make fun of him for that. It's very interesting that you would interpret that. The different thinkers would interpret the same period in different ways. But yeah, that's why you get this flourishing of intellectual activity at the time.
Right, right. Now, a lot of what I noticed in the Tao Te Ching was, like you mentioned, talking about how kind of conforming yourself to certain roles, trying to shape yourself in certain ways is unnatural and will lead to, if not ruin, unhappiness for you, right? And I think the really good way to contrast this is with the idea of roles in Confucianism. Just very briefly, could you take us through that idea? And then I think from there, it'll be good to segue into the Taoist sort of, you might say, the deconstruction of that.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of contemporary like Confucian scholars use the term role ethics, which is obviously not a term that Confucius himself used. But the general idea is here that you sort of have, again, you can think of it as like concentric circles. And I like to contrast it with like that famous Peter Singer analogy. It's like, well, if you see a child drowning in a pond, would you go in and save them, even if it like wrecked your expensive shoes that you just bought that cost $200. 99.99% of people go, of course I would step into the pond and save the drowning child. And Peter Singer goes, okay, well, you're happy to do that because the child, you see the child immediately and $200, whatever, that's not a problem. Why wouldn't you just donate $200 to save a child in Africa? Right? So Peter Singer's whole point is that the difference, the geospatial difference doesn't matter ethically. Whereas I guess Confucianism would completely disagree and would sort of conceive of morality as kind of like emanating out, not from the individual, which is like hyper-Western, but from the family. And so you learn morality through how to behave appropriately within certain roles. So before you can learn to be a good citizen, you've got to learn to be a good member of a family, right? And then you learn to be a member of like a good member of the tribe or the clan or the local village. Then you learn to be a good citizen of your nation state, if we're talking in contemporary terms. And then you learn to be a good citizen of the world. But the point is that you kind of like go out from the center. Like that's the way that humans actually learn to be moral. And I think there's probably like good psychological research on that, that like children learn, like, you know, how to respect others, like first in the family, then amongst their friends, and then they sort of gradually generalize that behavior outwards. So Confucianism is sort of just saying that, but you also have stronger moral ties like to your family than you do to someone else's family, or you have stronger moral ties to a citizen of your own country than you do to someone of another country. It's not denying that there might be like a broad humanitarian ethic. There is, but I think Confucian role ethics just says, but you do have stronger moral ties to someone that you actually know and are related to, because it's a relational ethic.
Right. And in terms of how political actors behave, there would be certain roles within a government, and it is ethically upon you in a sort of Confucian view, or would it be ethically upon you in this Confucian view, that you act in certain ways in those roles? You shape yourself to those roles.
Yeah, and so behaving ethically or behaving appropriately is determined by the role. It's a very like localized thing. And I think there's a quote in Confucius that like the father fathers, the son sons, the minister ministers, the ruler rules, or something to that effect. I've been reading a lot of like political realism at the moment for other reasons, but they talk about like politics as being a sort of a distinct sphere that has its own set of norms. I guess it's a sort of similar idea here with Confucianism. It's like each role has its own appropriate set of norms that are particular to that role and to that relationship. And so, you know, like it would even be like being a good friend is different from being a good son or a good brother. But you even like being a good friend to you is different to being a good friend to someone else. They're different. They're different relationships, and the norms look quite different in each context.
Right, right. Now, let's go to the Taoist's retort. Well, maybe not so much retort, but the Taoist stance on that idea, right, that you have to comport yourself in certain ways, in certain roles, in certain relationships, right?
Mm.
So there's quite a few aphorisms in here and quite a few very mystical-sounding quotes where Lao Tzu or whoever the authors are talk about exterminating the sage, discard the wise.
Yeah.
The best form of government is when it seems like no one is governing at all.
Mm.
Do not fill the brim, or don't fill the vessel all the way, or it will fall over. Right. Yeah. All of these sort of aphorisms and wise sounding quotes having to do with pretty much not taking those roles so seriously, right? You are not the role.
Yeah.
The role is something, and you can't sort of contort yourself to it. You know, I feel like the Taoist view is by doing that sort of thing, it's a contortion. It's a contortion of what you're supposed to be.
Yeah,
which is not something, which is not someone, rather, rigidly adhering to roles.
I think that's right. So basically, what you're describing is this idea of the uncarved block, which probably didn't jump out at you when you read it because you didn't know that that was like an important thing. But that's basically what you've just described. And so when I say he, really, it's many, many people.
The hive mind.
The hive mind of Taoism. when they talk about an uncarved block as being like the model human, what that meant, and the Chinese word is pu, P-U. It's basically the idea, it goes back to what I said about how Taoists thought that humans were naturally and spontaneously good in their original state. And Confucianism is all about these kind of like observing these moral norms of society and, as you say, comporting yourself to the role, and it's this very like contrived morality. Whereas the Taoists, like you described it quite well, it's like, you know, but if you do that, you're kind of forcing yourself into this sort of unnatural state, whereas humans are in their natural being this sort of uncarved block. That's, they're spontaneously good. And I think there's a line in the Tao Te Ching about like sometimes adding something makes it worse, taking away makes it better. And so humans are an uncarved block. We're naturally good. We're naturally in harmony with nature. It's this sort of, it's society that brings in the trouble, which sounds very Rousseauan actually. Like it's, and Rousseau is an interesting thinker to like contrast with all this, because he's sort of like, well, we have this kind of like natural freedom. Humans are sort of naturally good in the state of nature, but it's a kind of crude form of freedom. So we like construct a society to have this like higher form of freedom. But then we wake up one morning and we find that like in creating this society, we've gotten so lost in this constructive effort that we've actually lost track of the original freedom that we wanted to preserve. And so the best society is that which actually most closely mirrors the state of nature. It's this kind of bizarre, like you come full circle, but you have to actually go full circle to get. It's a similar sort of idea, or at least I think, and it's always dangerous to try and like read the Western stuff onto it. But it's a similar sort of idea here in Taoism, that you're sort of this uncarved block. And even though we live in a society, you want to try and just be as natural as possible.
Right, yeah. Right. So the attempt to create harmony through, in a forced way, through some sort of political imposition will result in disharmony in this view.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the purposes, like mythologically speaking, of this text is that, well, it's an interesting story. So basically, like Lao Tzu got fed up. He's like, oh, no one's listening to me. All these rulers, they're not following my advice. I'm out of here. I'm leaving China. So he walks out through central western China, passes through the Western Gate, which is like supposedly this mythical border of China, passes out through the Western Gate into where the barbarians live. And outside that, like no one knows. It's just barbarians. But the guy who's like at the gate goes, well, before you leave, can you write me a book with all your wonderful insights? And so he writes this book, mythologically. And so a lot of this book is addressed to rulers in the same way that the Analects is addressed to rulers. And as you say, like a lot of it is like, don't force people to behave in a certain way. Don't impose upon them. Even quite explicitly says like, don't have really high taxes. The best government is that which the people don't even know is there. It's kind of like guiding them behind the scenes. It doesn't impose upon their life. And so, yeah, that's all there. And I remember having an interesting conversation with an academic. She's Chinese. So I should probably defer to her a little bit because she obviously knows more about this than I do. But she was like, oh, it's interesting that you sort of like are reading these texts to almost critique liberalism, because I read them and I like find a lot of proto-liberalism in it, and I think that it's useful as like a weapon against the CCP. And the quotes that she mentioned were these quotes about like the good government is the one people don't know exist. And so is that like a defense of like small limited government? And I thought about that for a while, and I don't really think that's a good way to understand it. It's more just this idea that good governments take small incremental actions, and they see the natural course of things, and they kind of go with the grain rather than trying to force against it. That's more sort of the idea.
Right. And when I read that part of the text, and you just saying that again now, it reminded me, this is going to sound weird, but it's actually a very, very fitting comparison. You ever watched the show Futurama?
Yeah, I love Futurama. It's just shattered that it stopped.
Do you remember that episode where, I forget what happens to set it up, but like Bender gets stuck in space and then there's some like colony of beings that form on him. And they...
Yeah, I think so.
And it's this like microcosm of a world living on him. And he ends up acting as a sort of god for these little beings on him. By floating through space, he actually comes and meets God at some point. Like he just ends up ambling about there. And Bender's this sort of vulgar alcoholic robot character, but comes to care somewhat for these beings who are growing on him because they kind of defer to him so much. And in trying to act to their benefit, anytime he would intervene in their world, he would just sort of cause some new calamity and cause a bunch of suffering.
Yeah.
And then when he bumps into God, God in the show actually says something very similar where, I forget what the exact line is, but something along the lines of, well, the best way to rule them, well, the best way to run them is if they don't know that you're there at all.
Mm.
So if you want a good good view of Taoism as political philosophy, go watch that episode of Futurama.
Dude, I mean, it's such a good show. Yeah, that is actually a very, very apt.
I wouldn't be surprised if the writers actually had read this because it fits too well.
Yeah, that does fit. And like you even use the word microcosm, and like that's sort of like how people talk about the Taoist view of like humans and our lives are just microcosms of the macrocosm of like the broader system of things.
Mm-hmm.
And when these things are in alignment, then, you know, harmony prevails.
Wait, here we go. I found the exact passage. The best of all rulers is but a shadowy presence to his subjects. Next comes the ruler they love and praise. Next comes one they fear.
Mm.
Next comes one with whom they take liberties. When there's not enough faith, there is lack of good faith. Hesitant, he does not utter words lightly. When his task is accomplished and his work done, the people all say, it happened to us naturally.
Yeah, yeah. Can you read the first two lines again? So what's the best ruler and then the second best ruler?
Okay, so the best of all rulers is but a shadowy presence to his subjects. Next comes the ruler they love and praise.
Yeah, okay. So there's this, like, so in Confucianism, there's this idea that, like, a ruler should be morally virtuous and kind of leads by example. And sort of the aphorism in the Analects is, you know, when the wind blows, the grass will surely bend. And so that's the ruler demonstrating moral virtue and his subjects, like, follow. So that's the second best, is the sort of Confucian ruler. The third best is this like Machiavellian, it's better to be feared than loved. But the Taoism's point in this text at least is, actually like by being this sort of upstanding example of moral virtue, you introduce opportunities for envy and resentment. So the people who don't display this virtue might become resentful or become greedy, or you might get people who are motivated, who tried to act virtuously, but for ulterior reasons. And so the whole point is going back to this idea that we're naturally good. And as soon as you introduce this artificial system of like moral praise and moral virtue, you're corrupting that natural goodness. So that's, yeah, also what that's like alluding to.
Right. And there's just another thing I wanted to kind of ask you about here. He talks quite a lot about exterminating the sage, criticizing the wise.
Yeah.
Right? So what's the deal with that? Is a similar sort of thing where following the words of, say, philosophers and priests and whatnot, you're getting contorted out of your sort of natural way of being?
I think so. I think Taoism sometimes gets criticized for being really anti-intellectual, and certainly like that quote is super anti-intellectual. And there's also another passage where he talks about his ideal society, and it's basically like fat, dumb farmers. It's like their minds are empty, but their bellies are full. And then, like, I think that's literally what it says. And so you can kind of read it in a very sort of uncharitable way about, you know, given that this book was potentially intended as advice for rulers, like He also says don't educate your people, and don't educate them, don't give them desires, just make sure they're well fed and stupid, basically.
I thought that was really interesting, that part, because it seems to indicate that there's a view in Taoism that desire is learnt. You learn how to desire from others.
That's an interesting point. Yeah,
And there's I haven't read him, but there's a philosopher called René Girard. He talks about, he has a mimetic theory of desire. You desire things because you see, you learn from others that they desire them. And you try to mirror that desire in yourself, which, you know, this is, you know, a good 2,500 years and other side of the world over. So it's not like a one-to-one, but feels a lot like that idea.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also like, you know, Buddhism was introduced into China and sort of this idea about like, suffering is the is failing to recognize that everything is impermanent, and you hang on to things in this foolish belief that they could last forever. It's sort of that's being filtered through it as well, but becomes very Chinese. That's interesting. The desires are learned for sure. What was I saying? Oh yeah. So the sort of uncharitable way, or perhaps, you know, it's an equally valid reading, but one that we might want to like sidestep, is it's kind of almost this defense of this kind of totalitarian regime that deliberately keeps people dumb, doesn't educate them because then they're going to get fucking uppity and criticize the government. It's almost kind of like this brave new world, just keep the people stupid and pliant. I mean, that's definitely there, and you could read it that way, but I think the more fruitful reading is sort of the one that you alluded to, and it's this idea that if you're too analytic about things, if you're too scholarly about things, and you just kind of have this like myopic, narrow focus on life, you actually miss everything else. I think that's the sort of general idea.
Right. So like reason is an imposition on the world. It is not inherent to it.
That's definitely, I think,
Trying to filter this idea through sort of Western terms.
Yeah. I mean, I was also thinking about like the new atheists, you know, let there not be an episode of Ideas Matter where I don't bag the new atheists. But it's this like, you know, you can't really fault them for what they're saying literally, that everything should be like measurable and testable. And it's like, that's all good. And like, you know, it's a useful trait to have, but the problem is when you apply that to everything, and that's like your sole way of like existing, you actually are not knowledgeable, because there's so much that sits outside of that that you then just don't pay attention to. And it's kind of making fun of this, you know, that what do they say about economists? Someone who knows the price of everything but the value of nothing.
Mm.
It's like not this real. It's not real knowledge. And the more that you become an economist, the more you actually, like, don't know about society. I think it's the same sort of idea.
Right. So literally just keep vibing, man.
Literally, just keep vibing. Be like water, flow, go with the flow, natural harmony of the universe. And this is this idea of Wu Wei. It's like effortless action or effortless inaction. But inaction doesn't mean inactivity. It doesn't mean do nothing. It doesn't literally mean just like sit on the couch and be a potato.
So not the Big Lebowski.
Not the Big Lebowski, although that is a phenomenal film. It's basically just this idea of not forcing things, not striving. And that's why my favorite line in the whole book is know when to stop so that you can endure. And that's something that like I have put into my own life so much. Like when I'm training for, you know, martial arts or boxing, it's like sometimes I feel this like after class, like oh, I've still got a bit of energy in me, like maybe I'll go and do some weights by myself, or maybe I'll like keep training some more. And then ultimately what I found was that was self-defeating, because then the next day I'm not as well rested and I don't want to go to training that day. And so sometimes it's actually better to know when to stop so that you can keep going, and it's actually more productive to be like that rather than this sort of constant like beating yourself up for not doing enough, for forcing. Just like be in tune with your body, because your body is naturally in tune with the universe, and listen to that and follow that, and then you'll have more success. That's how I interpret it and imply it to my own life.
Right. That's interesting, because there was a passage I found in here that I was a little bit confused by, but you just made it make a lot of sense, where I'm trying to find it right now, but it's talking about how a ruler should give more give more of their focus and attention to their own body than to their rule, right? So it's this idea of, hang on, here we go. He who values his body more than dominion over the empire can be entrusted with the empire. He who loves his body more than dominion over the empire can be given custody of the empire. So it's, yeah, like the idea of don't push yourself beyond your limits. I think he's not sort of criticizing ruling or being a ruler. He's saying don't self-destruct within that process of doing what your job is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, I mean, you were kind of joking, I assume, but there's a grain of truth in what you said when it's like, well, you know, this is sort of, what if there's a philosopher who is the exact opposite of Nietzsche, right? Because Nietzsche's all about this will to power and, like, asserting yourself against the world and against other wills. And I think on the one hand, that's true. But what I would say to that is, like, well, again, inaction or Wu Wei is not about being passive per se. It's not about doing nothing and being a sort of, you know, neckbeard. It's, you can look at how it's like applied in the Chinese martial arts, where it's like similar to judo and jiu-jitsu, actually. It, rather than like meeting force with force, it's sometimes when your opponent is like being really tense and aggressive, the best thing for you to do is actually remain calm and just sidestep out of the way, and use their force against them. It's this sort of idea. It's not, again, this is my reading, but it's not like don't be active, don't be physical, don't like engage, don't combat with other wills. But sometimes the best way to do that is not by meeting force with force. It's by not striving. That's how I read it.
Right. So yeah, this is good, because I was wondering if we'd be able to touch on the philosophy of life stuff. And we've just done that. Is there anything else in regards to that, like the just general insights, philosophy of life kind of thing that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably this and Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. And there's a lot of interesting similarities, I think, between Taoism and Stoicism, because they both have this idea that like the universe has this sort of natural harmony to it that we should try and mirror. But yeah, so there's this like story, there's this famous painting in China called, should have looked this up, but it's basically like three sages tasting from a vinegar jar, right? And each person in the painting like represents a different school of thought. So you've got Confucius, you've got the Buddhist, and then you've got the Taoist, and they're all tasting this like really bitter vinegar. And the Confucian has the most sort of like sour, displeased face when he's doing this. So does the Buddhist, but the Taoist is just smiling, right? And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, like, the vinegar doesn't taste bad. It just tastes how it tastes. And then we as humans impose these like value judgments on it. And so what I take from that is, you know, just follow the way. Like, I'm going to work or to uni one day and I get caught in traffic. That's fine. Like, that was probably always going to happen, right? And what, there's no point in just sitting there and erupting and smashing your smoothie cup, as I did one time, and getting smoothie all over your, you know, passenger seat because you're so angry about the traffic. It's like, no, just chill. Like, just go with the flow, go with the way. What can you do in that scenario? Okay, maybe you can listen to an interesting podcast while you're in the traffic.
You can listen to Ideas Matter in
the
podcast.
You could listen to Ideas Matter.
In the traffic, rather.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's another thing in terms of, like, the philosophy of life, so to speak, that I sort of take from it.
Right. Yeah, I find that really valuable in this too. There's a lot of great sort of slice of life reminders. Like, even on my first read through, there was a lot of stuff that I found very, I don't know if obtuse is the right word, because it's not so much that the text is obtuse, but more my lack of understanding of it. But you do just find these things throughout, even if you aren't getting some of the other things that are great takeaways, great things to sort of live by.
Yeah.
So at least in that regard, I highly recommend it. And from the rest of the conversation, I also highly recommend it. Is there anything else you wanted to mention before we close out? Or
No, not really. I mean, I should just say, maybe I am not an expert on Chinese philosophy. I'm very much an amateur. So, like, don't, if I've gotten something wrong, if I've made a horrible faux pas, cool. Just let me know. I'm not pretending to like be an expert on these things because I've not read the text in classical Chinese. So yeah, just a bit of like humility there, I suppose. But this is probably one of my favorite works of philosophy. I don't agree with everything. You know, and I'm like devoting my life to academia, so obviously I don't go the whole way in terms of making fun of scholars, right?
Yeah, you don't want to exterminate the sages.
I don't want to exterminate the sages, no. But I also understand like the grain of truth in where Lao Tzu is coming from. So if you're someone who like is anxious and is also very, very hard on yourself and like beat yourself up a lot and feels this like this forcing and you've constantly like under this tension to achieve and to do more, which is very much like sort of how I think a lot of people feel today, particularly like people of our generation in this like hyper-competitive society. Reading Taoism is quite useful because it reminds you that none of this actually matters. You're probably going to come to an untimely end if you're constantly stressing and forcing yourself. And sometimes to get the best results, you just need to relax and go with the flow. And it's not, relaxing and going with the flow is not the antithesis of doing things and being productive. It's actually sometimes the key to it. So I really like Taoism.
I think that's a fantastic note to end on. All right. Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Thank you.